Welcome to Stand in the Gap Today with Sam Rohr, Barry Dahl, and David Kistler of the American Pastors Network, addressing the most critical issues impacting our culture from a biblical and constitutional perspective. Learn more about the work of the American Pastors Network at AmericanPastorsNetwork.net.
Well, welcome to Stand in the Gap Today. This is Sam Rohr. Gary Dahl will be with me today. David Kistler is gone. Our special guest today will join us just a little bit later. George Barna, Executive Director of the American Culture and Faith Institute. Now, ladies and gentlemen, with the appointment of General Kelly to head the Department of Homeland Security and Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt to lead the EPA, the Trump administration continues to come into focus reducing the skepticism of some, at the same time increasing the alarm of others. We're going to talk about these appointments in the context of meeting expectations of the voting public and why that's important. Now, in segment two, we're going to bring in our special guest, George Barna. And with this week's research, we're going to have him reveal to us what that is. And it's really dealing with Trump's honeymoon transition period being helped by one particular group of people. And George is going to identify this group and how the degree of meeting expectations by the Trump administration will impact the years ahead by possibly impacting how these people and others actually respond. We're going to conclude then with the necessary components of what must be done by Christian conservatives and the church in the months and the years ahead, if God wills, if lasting change is really going to occur. Well, Gary, the Trump administration continues to build out in a very interesting way, and really these last couple of appointments just announced last evening by Donald Trump really, to me, are significant. I'm going to get the implications of a couple of these here in just a minute, but let me talk about one in particular. That is General Kelly. He was tapped to head the Department of Homeland Security, which is an agency of over 240,000 federal employees. It's a behemoth, and it really has not been run well. It's been plagued with a lot of management problems. Kelly is 66 years old. He is described by some people, I'm going to read one quote as a description, quote, he is a blunt-spoken border security hawk who clashed with the Obama administration over women in combat and plans to close the prison at Guantanamo Bay, according to people familiar with that decision, end quote. In the end, this choice for Homeland Security Secretary came down between two primary people, Representative Mike McCaul, from Texas, chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, and General Kelly. But General Kelly beat out this individual, Mike McCaul, because some said he was insufficiently tough on border security. I would like to think that it had to do with the fact that Michael McCaul, as we've talked about in his program, is actually very soft on the Muslim Brotherhood. And he was not the kind of individual who should have headed Homeland Security. So there, that's a major choice indicated by the Trump administration there. Known inside the Pentagon as a thoughtful man who continued serving his country even after his son was killed in combat, General Kelly has talked in stark terms, much like Trump, about the threats America faces in the Middle East and beyond. In speeches, he's expressed frustration with what he calls the bureaucrats in Washington, and he's described the military's counterterrorism operations abroad as a war against a savage enemy who would gladly launch more deadly attacks. Gary, he made one other statement, which I think I'm going to read here. He said this, given the opportunity to do another 9/11, our vicious enemy would do it today, tomorrow, and every day thereafter. And he said that in 2013. He went on and said, I don't know why they hate us. I frankly don't care. But they do hate us, and they're driven irrationally to our destruction. Gary, the point I want to make here, and I wanted to get your response on, is that some of Trump's opponents are criticizing him because they're saying there are too many military types around him. General Flynn, security advisor, James Mattis as Secretary of Defense, and now General Kelly. Now, I just want to ask you a simple question. Does it bother you that Donald Trump has chosen to put in a few of these key positions military individuals? And is there anything really to be concerned about these individuals, or the fact that there are three of the number right now who are retired military?
Well, Sam, first of all, welcome back. Just to let our people know, you had some physical difficulties, but you stand on the Rock of Ages, and we're delighted to have you back.
ladies and gentlemen, you've got to understand that I had a bout with kidney stones over the last couple of days. So Gary, these guys have been ribbing me to death on that. So the Rock of Ages, Gary, it's not a kidney stone, but I do stand on the Rock of Ages. So thank you.
But we are delighted to have you back, and. First of all, I want to say also praise the Lord for General Kelly, because I think that he's just the kind of an individual that we need in there at the Department of Homeland Security, keeping in mind that that was brought together right after 9/11, and I think the first director was Tom Ridge here from Pennsylvania, and the reason was is because that our security forces were not really talking to each other, and that's why George Bush brought it together. But there have been all sorts of different issues in there ever since. And I think General Kelly would be the one to bring this all together. But as to your question, it does not bother me, the generals that Donald Trump has on board right now. I would encourage people to read his book called The Art of the Deal. Because in that particular book, Sam, Donald Trump brings out, and this was before he ever ran for the presidency, he brings out that when he goes to do something, he tries to find the individuals who he believes will do the best job in getting the job done. And I think that these individuals that he has chosen, including these generals that he has around him right now, or those who will potentially serve on his cabinet, I think he is simply trying to find the people who will do the best job for the hour in which we live. And all of these individuals, at least most of them, seemingly, from my perspective, qualify. But the thing that people are complaining about is the fact that we now have the military in the White House on the president's cabinet. Keep in mind that these generals are now civilians. Sure, they served in the military. Sure, they have high-ranking positions such as general. But they are now retired. They are no longer a part of the military. They are civilians, and they are selected to do those individual civilian jobs in the president's cabinet, in the presidential administration. I see no problem with it. I know people are concerned about it, but I do not see any kind of a constitutional problem here as some people are trying to display it as being.
Well, Gary, I think it's excellent that you said what you said, because that is the concern on some people's parts. But you are correct. You are absolutely correct that in a civilian capacity, and these generals, I have heard them all speak to the fact of understanding that it is a civilian role, not a military role. And I think that's a key factor. But they do bring discipline and an understanding. I think that's something that Trump is tapping. Ladies and gentlemen, when we come back after the break, we're going to now welcome in our guest, George Barna, and we're going to go to the research related released for this week, and it deals with Trump's honeymoon transition period, and we're going to talk to him about who this group is that really is helping, I guess, in this honeymoon period, and talk through a number of applications and implications of this entire thing. Stay with us. We're going to be right back.
Christian parents want their children to excel in spiritual growth and educational achievement. Both are essential for future success in an increasingly complex world full of moral and economic challenges. BJU Press Materials place great value on the knowledge of God in His works. They teach critical thinking skills your child will need to get along both now and in the future. BJU Press Materials are available for grades K-12. From the earliest grades, they teach biblical Christianity as a system of God-revealed truths. BJU Press Materials are well written, grade level appropriate, and biblically integrated. Teachers' editions assure that instructors have the plans and extra tools to keep your child engaged and excited about learning by teaching your child how to analyze, evaluate, and ultimately create new solutions. And that's just what today's workplace is looking for. If you're a Christian school teacher or administrator, a homeschool teacher, or a parent who just wants your child to learn more, start by exploring the BJU Press website. Visit bjupress.com. That's bjupress.com.
Securities and advisory services offered through Genios Wealth Management, member FINRA and SIPC.
Today, people are living longer than their forebears. Right now, more than 1 million Americans are alive past age 100. That means you need to work toward having financial resources that can give you independence into your golden years. But weighing different investment options may make you feel overwhelmed. You need someone, a trusted friend, who can come alongside and help you keep the complex simple. That's where the Life Financial Group comes in. For nearly 40 years, the Life Financial Group has helped thousands of families, not only here in Pennsylvania, but nationwide, become even better financial stewards of God's blessings. Managing your investments may feel challenging, but by using a complete financial stewardship approach, you too can gain confidence and peace of mind that your wealth is protected and that you maintain your financial independence. With morally clean investment options, we can help you reach your goals while honoring your convictions. Call us at the Life Financial Group today at 610-385-4500 or online at thelifegroup.org. That's thelifegroup.org.
History was made on today's date. Stay tuned for an American Minute with Bill Federer.
On this day, December 8, 1863, President Abraham Lincoln announced his plan of pardon for the South. He wrote, "Whereas it is desired by some persons engaged in said rebellion to resume their allegiance to the United States, I, Abraham Lincoln, proclaim a full pardon upon the condition that every such person take an oath, to wit, I do solemnly swear in the presence of Almighty God that I will henceforth faithfully support, protect, and defend the Constitution, and that I will faithfully support all proclamations of the President made during the existing rebellion having reference to slaves. So help me God."
This has been an American Minute with Bill Federer. For a free transcript, call American Minute at 1-888-USA-WORD.
Jan Mark Hill, helping you understand the times.
The word racist has been used to describe numerous acts, from racial profiling to popular music. But is it the right word to characterize a complicated issue?
Race does matter to God, and it would be great if we included him into more discussions on race. It was God's idea to create humans of all races in his image. Therefore, what God has created, we should not hate. If God is the creator of the races, then let's get him more involved in trying to help us sort it out. If race is a Christ matter, then it is in him that we will find the answers to these issues. If the police and the African American community can allow God to tear down the wall of separation, then we will save some lives and find the peace we all need for our communities. For more information, listen to our weekend program on this station or anytime at olivetreeviews.org.
You're listening to Stand in the Gap Today, the daily radio program of the American Pastors Network. For more information, visit the APN website, AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. And now, let's rejoin Stand in the Gap Today.
Well, welcome back, and this is Stand in the Gap Today, and I want to encourage all of you who are listening across the country, again, to go to our website, StandinTheGapRadio.com. Visit there, get familiar and frequently visiting that site if you can, because we post a lot of information across a number of issues, as well as then all of the archives of all three of our radio programs, Stand in the Gap Minute, Stand in the Gap Today, which is this one, and the Weekend Best of Week, which we call Stand in the Gap Weekend. They're all there, along with a lot of other additional information. Now, with that being said, I'd like to welcome in right now our special and recurring guest, George Barna. He is the Executive Director of American Culture and Faith Institute. And, George, welcome to Stand in the Gap Today.
Sam and Gary, great to be with you again.
It is a pleasure to always have you with us, George. We look forward to it every other week, and we missed you the week of Thanksgiving because it was Thanksgiving, and we did other things. So there's a lot of information that may have even been released in the last couple of weeks that you may want to highlight on, but the title of your release this week is Christian Conservatives Provide a Comfortable Honeymoon Period for the Trump Transition. And I want you to tell us about that and why you think that is. But before I go there and have you break that out, I'd like to have you just do a 2 to 3 minute quick review of putting 2016 into a perspective, if you could, overall, from the standpoint of Christian conservatives, where they started 2016 when you were interviewing, what their attitudes were going into that heavily populated Republican primary and so forth, and then how it modified to Trump versus Clinton, and then how it moved even up to this point. If you could kind of wrap this whole thing up and give us a 10,000-foot overview of the movement, because this was not a smooth line throughout 2016.
No, it's interesting because when you look back, what you remember is almost a year ago, last January, Donald Trump was running about fifth among all the Republican primary candidates when we look at conservative Christians. So there were, seven or eight evangelical candidates that were running. So the conservative Christian vote was essentially being split among those different candidates. But as time went on and Mr. Trump was able to cobble together a coalition of not just conservative Christians, but other people around the country who were looking for the kind of leadership he was offering, what we saw was that eventually by the time he got the nomination, and he was clearly the front runner for the nomination around May, what we found was that Christian conservatives were willing to get behind him. And so his support rose from about 11% back at the beginning of January among Christian conservatives up to 71% by the middle of May. And then what we had happening over the course of the rest of the election season was a lot of Christians, that remaining 3 out of 10, really struggling with what were they going to do. Were they going to vote but not for a presidential candidate? Would they vote for a third party or independent candidate? There was really never much chance that many conservative Christians were going to vote for Hillary Clinton, and that, in fact, took place. Almost none of them did. But what we saw was that things progressed where you had a lot of Christian ministries, nonprofit organizations working outside of the local church who were trying to get conservative Christians educated about the issues, trying to get them excited about the race, and seemed to do a pretty good job of doing that, because what we found over the last 3 months in particular was that there was a major shift among conservative Christians in terms of what they perceived to be the most significant issues in the election. So they moved away from things like the economy and health care and immigration, and instead they began to realize this election really is, in many ways, mainly about things like abortion and the Supreme Court and its long-term impact that it's going to have on the nation, and religious freedom. And so what we also saw over those last 3 months was that Mr. Trump's support among the SageCons, the spiritually active governance-engaged conservatives, we saw that his support among that group rose from that 71% mark in mid-May to 93% on election day. More than 90% of those people turned out. They did so with reservations about his character. But when they looked at Mrs. Clinton, they had even more reservations about her character. So it really came back to issues. They couldn't get somebody with the kind of character they wanted, so they recognized that, particularly after that third debate, when Chris Wallace asked the question about where do you two stand on abortion, that was a solidifying moment for the Trump campaign among conservative Christians. Now, in spite of that huge support, 93% of them voting for Mr. Trump, 6 out of 10 of them expected Mrs. Clinton to win. And so in the end, many of them turn back and, they look backwards and they say, maybe all the prayer movement that was going on, the fasting that was taking place, the many Christian ministries outside of the local church, that made a difference. There were some churches that participated by, preaching about the issues, not very many, but some did that. And by the way, in the end, we found that 80% of theologically conservative pastors wound up voting for Mr. Trump as well. Mm. So it really was a significant shift that took place from the beginning of the year until the end of the election. And many people, myself included, would say it was a miraculous move of God that put Mr. Trump in the White House. He is not our savior, but he may give us a chance to make things right in this culture.
George, it's interesting how that is you know, the transition took place from a year ago and up until the election. And I think I've said on this particular program that out of the 17 Republican candidates who ran in the primary election, Donald Trump was about 23rd in my mind. And I could not figure out why some of these Christian leaders were coming out in favor of him, but they did. And, of course, even on this program, you know, we encourage people to stand behind Trump simply because of the positions that he took that, of course, you elaborated upon there in these last few minutes. But I do have two questions for you. Number one, you mentioned that even though 93% of the SageCons voted for Donald Trump, why do you think that 59% of them really expected Hillary to win? And then the second question I have goes right along with your release yesterday where you said that the Christian conservatives are providing a comfortable honeymoon period for the Trump transition. Why do you believe that that is taking place as well?
Well, let's go to your first question, which is why, if so many of these people were supporting Donald Trump, did they expect Hillary to win? And there's one simple answer, and that's the reporting that everybody was exposed to from the mainstream media. You look at the consistency of the message that was given across, the way that they portrayed and characterized Mr. Trump, the way that they characterized and portrayed Mrs. Clinton. And so naturally the impression that we all got was, well, it's a done deal. You know, all we have to do is cast the votes, count them up, and Hillary will be the president. But we also know from our research that 99% of SageCons, the spiritually active, governance-engaged conservatives, said that they believe that the media during the course of the election, their reporting of the election process was unfair and subjective.
Yeah.
So they got to a place where they stopped believing as best they could. I mean, when you're just surrounded with it, it's hard to know what else to think. But as best they could, they started shifting where they were getting their information from. And what we saw was by the end of the election, rather than the mainstream media being the primary source of their election news, they had turned to independent online sources, and that became the number one source. So that enabled a lot of them to see through the media fog to understand, you know, maybe what was really going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so to your second question as to why there's this comfortable honeymoon period, when you've got a group where 93% are giving that kind of support to a candidate, they're naturally going to come around that candidate afterwards to continue to encourage that individual to make sure that he or she has some leeway in terms of how they then begin to build the foundations for how they hope to govern, who they hope to govern with, what their agenda is going to be. And I think that's exactly what we see happening with Mr. Trump. Most of the public doesn't realize, but he has several different advisory groups around him who are helping him to identify potential picks for each of these groups. You know, and we've been asked to give him names and reasons for why these individuals might be appropriate. And I got to tell you, a lot of the people who are involved in these groups, not a majority, but a very significant number, are evangelical leaders. Mm. Why? Because during the course of the campaign, they prayed for him. They prayed with him. They were advising him. They were encouraging him. And he, frankly, did not get a whole lot of that on the campaign trail.
George, I hate to jump in here, but I want to anyway, because you just said something that I think is key. You say, we have been asked to give him some advice. 15 seconds. Can you elaborate upon that?
Well, I mean, there are different people that get turned to give suggestions, to give perspective on individuals based on their own personal experiences, their areas of expertise.
And but you've been a part of that? You've been a part of that group to give some advice, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Well, good for you. And I think this is one of the reasons why we see that Donald Trump is coming up with some very good people as potential candidates for the for his cabinet, Sam.
It is indeed, Gary. And George, thank you for that input here. We're going to, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to come back after the break now. We're going to continue further into this. by looking at the ramifications, the expectations of these sage cons. They didn't expect Trump to win, but now that he's in, what difference does it make? We're going to look at what that means now to the fulfilling of these expectations. What are they going to do about it?
Kings or Parliament could not give the rights essential to happiness. We claim them from a higher source, from the King of Kings and Lord of all the earth. They are not annexed to us by parchments and seals. They are created in us by the decrees of Providence, which established the law of our nature. They are born with us, exist with us, and cannot be taken from us by any human power without taking our lives. A quote from John Dickinson, 1804.
Fox News Radio. I'm Chris Foster. Fox confirms President-elect Trump has chosen a fast food executive as labor secretary. Andrew Puzder is CEO of CKE Restaurants. That's Hardee's, Carl's Jr., and others. The pick to run the Environmental Protection Agency.
Scott Pruitt is now the attorney general for the state of Oklahoma. He has a lengthy history as a staunch defender of state rights, and he has also repeatedly challenged federal restrictions dealing with environmental issues.
Fox's David Lee Miller outside Trump Tower in New York. A strong earthquake off the coast of Northern California. Here's Julie Dutton with the U.S. Geological Survey.
The earthquake is actually about 150 kilometers off the coast of California, so it will probably be felt in California, but as far as damage, we're not expecting anything.
And we don't have any reports of damage or anyone hurt. Fox News, we report, you decide.
From the Pennsylvania Family Institute, I'm Michael Gear with today's Family Update. The idea that Christians and their pastors would hold to biblical views about marriage and human sexuality seems to be scandalous in some circles these days. Take the uproar that started last week when the website BuzzFeed published an article saying that the pastor of the church where hosts Chip and Joanna Gaines of the HGTV show Fixer Upper attend opposes same-sex marriage, and who knows, maybe they do too. The whole idea of the article is to try and scare Bible-believing Christians from making their views public. It's part and parcel of the ongoing attacks on religious liberty, the freedom to believe, and standing for the truth that marriage is the union of one man and one woman. Worse yet, these types of attacks seek to prevent Christians from even getting jobs or obtaining licensing to be counselors, attorneys, or medical professionals. We need to stick together and stand up for truth, and I invite you to join with the Pennsylvania Family Institute to do so. Go to pafamily.org for more information.
You're listening to Stand in the Gap Today, the daily radio program of the American Pastors Network. For more information, visit the APN website, AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. And now, let's rejoin Stand in the Gap Today.
As we continue now with our guest, George Barna. George, I'd like to pick up where we left off in that last conversation. We were talking about the sage cons, the Christian conservatives, how they really ebbed and flowed throughout 2016. But then I think the number was 93% came around and voted for Trump. They have and stated in some of your material that they have a high expectation for him in certain things, that he would, for instance, would be much better. 95% thought he'd be better at creating jobs, as an example, than Hillary Clinton. Regulatory relief, those kinds of things, they felt that he would be there. And I'm wanting to go down that road a little bit right now of expectations and what that means and how you see that perhaps influencing these Christian conservatives in the positions that they may take in these months and the years ahead. Now, let me just take this one for an example here. 95% by 95% margin, Sage Khan said they expect Trump would do a better job at creating jobs. In reality, when I look and we look at what the news is right now, He is already, he's not even president, but he is already being hailed as saving 1,000 carrier jobs in Indiana, thousands of Ford jobs in Kentucky that decided that they were not going to move to Kentucky. The Dow is set to surpass 20,000. U.S. Steel says that they're going to be rehiring and look forward to rehiring 10,000 laid off employees due to some of these directly to what Trump is going to do. Just this last week, SoftBank of Japan, this individual committed to putting in $50 billion into the U.S. economy, creating 50,000 jobs. It looks like this is really off to a good start. Now, George, what I want to ask you right here in this in regard is this. From the standpoint of greater political engagement on the part of Christian conservatives going forward, how likely will continued positive performance on the part of the Trump administration in doing what he said he was going to do, how motivating is that going to be to Christian conservatives to further engage? Or I want to get deeper into that question, but where do you think they are in their mind based on what we know right now? And because obviously they went into this not expecting him to win, but if he would win, they expected him to do more things in the creation of jobs and so forth, which obviously is appearing to be the case.
Well, I'll be honest with you. I'm actually a little bit concerned about that very thing, because if you look historically at how this has worked, what tends to happen is we rise up when we feel threatened. That's when we get involved, or if we feel persecuted, and we take action. But when somebody comes along who is a strong leader, who has the capacity to do things, my fear is that it will give us a false sense of comfort. And so what will happen is that we'll stand back, we'll watch, we'll applaud, we'll say, yep, that's my guy, he's going to do it, without realizing that. But the only way that it has any lasting power within a culture, because politicians come and go, policies come and go, all of that. So what lasts is the people enforcing their will on the culture. And what we've got to have is the conservative Christian body saying, God has relented and given us a window of opportunity here. We've got to recognize that this is not now a time to simply be thankful. Yes, we ought to be thankful, but this is his way of kind of kicking us gently in the pants and saying, okay, now let me see what you got. Let's go for it. These things that I've taught you, these principles I've given you, these resources I've entrusted to you, take all of these things and convert them into a kind of society that will glorify me. And so I hope that we will do that. I think right now there's certainly on the part of most conservative Christians we're seeing in the research, there's the hope of the restoration within our culture of things like civility and respect and unity and prosperity and liberty. But I'm also worried that because we're not used to going out and making that happen, that once again we're going to watch and wait and hope without taking the bull by the horns and saying, okay, let's move it forward.
And George, that really, you go right to the heart of what I am wanting to bring out and ask our listeners to think as a part of this. You mentioned, and I agree fully, that that Christian people, maybe people in general, tend to respond to pressure or to threats of freedom, other things being lost. And I would have to think that in part, other than the Holy Spirit moving in the hearts of people, and I think that which obviously we know that happened, that part of it happened because people were concerned about what they thought was going to happen if Hillary Clinton was elected. And you mentioned that historically the rule is that when the pressure's off, people go to sleep. And I think that's a fear that I have as well. Now, in the context of looking at the needs that face us as a nation, You referenced the culture. We are all about that on this program, about reshaping the culture, impacting the culture for Christ, making it more God-fearing, making, trying to do what we can to make it of a better condition so God can bless it. Now, these Christian conservatives that you're talking about, and which would affect perhaps many of those who are listening to the program right now, they probably are looking at this, and to some extent we breathe a sigh of relief that all of the media angst and so forth prior to the election is passed. We all tend to breathe a little bit more deeply. And when some of these good things begin to happen, I think it's easy for us to go to sleep. Now, back to the aspect of changing the culture here and tying this together. I am wondering, George, and you can give me your comment on this. We can perhaps view some of these changes that Trump is making and his appointments are talking about in any of these various cabinet levels, reducing regulations. We can see what the results of that are. It produces excitement or jobs coming back or that kind of thing. These are good things. They are producing a good euphoria, a good sense of activity. But at the end of the day, George, is that what we need to change a culture? And I am wondering about this. Do we not run the risk, perhaps, if we're not careful, that we evaluate some of these changes purely politically and saying, well, they are Trump conservative policies and they're better than Clinton liberal policies, rather than saying that perhaps the things that work employ a biblical principle that we ought to begin pulling out as a way of referencing maybe when things work, why they work, and going to the root of that? You know what I'm talking about? Speak to that if you could.
Yeah, I think there are a number of ways to approach what you're bringing up, and they're all good concerns. You know, on the one hand, I think we're wrestling right now within the body of Christians in America with a leadership challenge. You would think that in a time such as this, this would be when church leaders, when our pastors and elders and other people in our churches would rise up and say, we've been put here for such a time as this. God has given us the principles that will help us to shape the culture more appropriately, to restore that kind of balance and sanity that we need, and to bring us back to a culture of righteousness and you know, as you mentioned, being a God-fearing people. I think the challenge that we have, though, is that most of our senior pastors, to be just real honest about it, have not been trained in places where they've been taught to lead. They've been taught to teach, which is good. We need great Bible teaching. That's certainly a part of the equation. But we also need strong backbone, visionary leadership from our spiritual leaders so that we can put together our spiritual truths and principles along with the political realities of the day, understand how God wants us to move forward, what he wants us to try to achieve in order to honor him as best we can. You know, and the reality is that people are people. Some are going to sit back now and watch because they feel, okay, well, we did what we needed to do. We voted on November 8th. I'm done for 4 years. Other people are just going to sit back and, you know, look at what's going on, and occasionally they'll go out and they'll pillage the culture because as things get better, assuming that they do, they'll take for themselves because they think, ah, look at what God's provided to me. Bad worldview, perhaps, but that's how they're going to see it. It's that other group, you know, that you and I and Gary often talk about as the remnants, who we're going to need to rely upon to be spreading the word, to be helping people to gain a different perspective about what this little window of opportunity means, and to recognize that although we may not be comfortable with it, politics, frankly, is the art of compromise and symbolism. And so as Christians, because of what we have in the scriptures, we're comfortable with symbolism. We understand that some things are symbolic. They represent other things, and they move us in a direction because of that. But we've also got to recognize that policymaking is not an extreme practice. You don't go from A to Z in one shot. Usually it takes several iterations to get where we want to go. We've got to be willing to dig in and fight that fight and not get tired in well doing to get us to the place we need to be.
George, great comments, and I want to pick up on some of those in our next segment. When you made a reference to that, we have senior pastors, many of whom have never been taught how to really lead. We're going to talk about that, and particularly in certain areas, and I'm going to put in that perhaps the areas of civil government. Ladies and gentlemen, when we come back after this break, we're going to continue with George Barnum. Gary and I will talk with him about what we can do going into 2017 and what we must do in order to change the culture.
Live, love, learn, and leave a legacy. These are great words, but if you want to leave a legacy to your children and grandchildren these days, it's going to take some careful planning. And that's where we come in. We're the Life Financial Group, advisors you can trust. We're Christian, families based upon the Bible, so that we can say we truly understand your values. In fact, for nearly 40 years, folks of all ages have counted on us to care for and grow their financial resources. Through prayer, prudent investment, and pleasant, knowledgeable people, we can help you navigate your investments so you feel secure. We're glad to offer morally clean investment options that won't sear your conscience or make you anxious. We're also comfortable talking about increasing the impact of your charitable giving. How do we make a difference? So learn how you can have peace of mind by calling us today at 610-385-4500. That's 610-385-4500. Or online at thelifegroup.org. That's thelifegroup.org.
Securities and advisory services offered through Genius Wealth Management, member FINRA and SIPC.
Hello, this is Sam Rohr. Although the term Christian education doesn't occur in the Bible, it does speak of the moral and spiritual instruction of children. It places a high value on knowledge, both of God and His works. It describes the moral and spiritual fruits of this knowledge and defines its ultimate purpose, the growth of your child in godliness of character and action. That's why we suggest you consider BJU Press K-12 materials. Your child's a unique individual created for a specific purpose. Proper instruction that includes the Bible and the relational influence of godly teachers produces a pure heart and a willing mind. The Bible calls that success. BJU Press materials are well written, grade level appropriate, and biblically integrated. They teach critical thinking skills and keep your child engaged and excited about learning. If you're a Christian school teacher or administrator, a homeschool teacher, or a parent who just wants your child to learn more, start by exploring the BJU Press website. Visit BJUPress.com. That's BJUPress.com.
Pennsylvania Leadership Charter School is an online public school for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Founded in 2004, our mission is to have a school where children can see the world, develop character, promote independence, and become lifelong learners. We teach our students to be leaders, thinkers, and scientists. They are taught to be logical and critical in thinking. Some of our classical teaching methods range from online class lectures to debates to Socratic teaching, which develops the art of speaking and writing. We encourage our students to be well-rounded by participating in sports, the arts, and their communities. Your child can benefit from this style of innovative education. Visit us at palcs.org or call 1-877-725-2785.
Here's Minute with the Master, brought to you by Bella Victor.
Today's question is, what did Jesus come to earth for? Jesus came to save us from sin. In Matthew 1:2, an angel told Joseph, "She will give birth to a son, and you shall give him the name Jesus, because he will save his people from their sins." Sin corrupted the earth. Sin closed a relationship with God. Sin caused death. But God, out of love for the world, gave his only begotten Son. Luke 1:19 gives a beautiful picture of God's love for us. The Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. Jesus came to earth for us, to connect with us to God, to save us. And because of Jesus, God will not impute our sin to us. In Romans 4:8 we read, "Blessed is the man to whom the Lord will not impute sin." My dear friends, believe in Jesus and be saved.
This is A Liberating Truth, brought to you by Bella Victor. For more information, contact Bella at MinuteWithTheMaster.com.
You're listening to Stand in the Gap Today, the daily radio program of the American Pastors Network. For more information, visit the APN website, AmericanPastorsNetwork.net. And now, let's rejoin Stand in the Gap Today.
In this last segment, we just had a great discussion with George Barna. And George, you made a comment in response to a question that I posed to you, that in this period of time now after the Trump election, where it appears that good appointments are being made, there is a positive sense that's developing on the part of many people that the tendency for folks to do is to go back to sleep, which is exactly what we cannot permit to happen. You made a reference that in this effort of going forward, and you were careful in how you said it, but you said, unfortunately, and which we'd agree, many senior pastors themselves in pulpits of America, on the broad perspective, really were not at all contributory to either to the election, to participating in it, or really even to be significantly engaged or concerned about impacting truly the culture for Christ. That really comes down to, you use the word, we've talked about it here, remnant pastors. Now, I want to, in this last remaining moments of the program, I want to go to where we should be going here in 2017 and where this leadership needs to be taken from and what our goal needs to be. George, I know you are a researcher. You've been researching for over 30 years. You have a lot of knowledge, and sometimes that can be helpful, and sometimes it can be you know too much. But our people need encouragement today, and we need a direction. Now, you advised we can't go back to sleep. I agree. We cannot go back to sleep. We've got to go forward. We think the Pastors Network that pastors really need to take the lead. We know that many of them will not. That being said, George Barna, I'm going to ask you. We want a change in this culture that takes it back to be more God-fearing, a culture that reflects a biblical worldview, a culture that can that we can expect God's blessing on it, as our founders did. Would you describe briefly from your perspective what it is that we need to change? And then I want to talk about who needs to take that lead. But if we talk at the culture, put it in a practical way, if we could say, all right, we want to change what's out ahead of us in 2017 and beyond, what do we need to change, George?
Well, it's hard to encapsulate that in a couple of minutes, but we could certainly start by saying we have to understand that we are here to honor God. And so everything that we create is supposed to be something that ultimately glorifies God and advances his agenda. So we need to look at our culture and say, okay, is everything that we're creating, everything we're producing, everything that we're upholding, is this something that God looks at and says that is good? I think that needs to be the filter that we've got to be looking to as we look at the culture. I think clearly as we look at what kind of movies we're producing, the music that becomes popular, television programs, you know, a lot of the media probably does not meet that standard. I think when we look at what's coming out of our schools, the kinds of language, the kinds of worldview that's being taught, which is predominantly postmodern, I don't think that necessarily meets the standards. I think when we look at what's going on within our family units, even though most Americans would say that they support traditional moral values, there's a disconnect between what they think they represent and what their behavior suggests. And so once again, there's kind of a disconnect there. You know, there are all these different areas that help to define what makes up a culture. And I think if we were to go back and say, okay, well, let's start to develop some metrics, some measurements that will help us to determine not how we feel about these things, but what do the facts show about who we really are and what we promote and what we represent. One of the things that always hurts me when I travel abroad and speak at churches and places abroad, people in other countries look at America and they feel sorry for us. Because they say, you know what, you've lost your way. You were once that great, you know, shining light on the hill. Now you're shrouded in darkness, and you're trying to take us down with you. And so I think this is a great period of time for us to sit back and not stay sitting back, only so that we can gear up intelligently and strategically to figure out where do we need to go. You know, you look at the military. Why is the military effective? They're effective because they're always alert and they're always assessing threats. Mm-hmm. And as the church, I think that's one of the things that we can bring to the table.
Absolutely.
Speaking into the culture, you know what, this is what we see. This is why we believe that this is not good. Here are some principles that God has given to us to help figure out how can we turn things around, how can we change it. So, you know, I would go back to Romans 5 and say, look, you know, God tells us that we're going to face trials, but we've got to endure. And I think partly we've endured through the Obama years. We faced a lot of trials there. We would have faced more under Mrs. Clinton, but we endured. And now, you know, that endurance hopefully has produced that kind of character in us that will point us back to God and His Word and His ways. And that's what will give us hope for the future, because we will be committed to bringing His principles into play.
George, again, we so much appreciate your presence with us on the program regularly. But going back to what you said in the last segment, I have a lot of questions. Simply as it relates to the senior pastors and the position of the pastoral leadership. And we often talk about strong pastoral leadership on this particular program, but you made a statement that I would like for you to share with our listeners briefly, if you can, and for the sake of our pastors who are listening. You said that, you know, our pastors are taught to teach, but they're not really taught to lead. But then you used the phrase that what we need today is strong backbone spiritual leadership. Strong backbone spiritual leadership. What does strong backbone spiritual leadership look like in the pulpit? What should it look like? How can it be developed?
Well, again, this is probably a longer discussion, but briefly, I mean, you have to understand what leadership is. I know you guys do, but I mean, for all of us to have kind of a common view of that, my perspective on it is that what a leader does is to motivate, mobilize, resource, and direct people in the pursuit of a shared vision that advances God's agenda. So what we need are individuals who have the capacity, in other words, to engage people, the people who they have the opportunity to impact and influence, you know, their congregants largely, but even outside the church, people that they come in contact with and they have some impact upon, engage those people in a shared vision. And this is one of the hallmarks of a leader, and it's one of the distinctions between a leader and a teacher. Teachers don't go around concerned about vision. They go around concerned about passing on what they believe is important information. And that's very important in the overall process. But there's a big distinction between trying to engage people in information and trying to engage them in a movement of activity that changes the course of history so that it advances God's agenda. Those kind of people are the ones that we need leading our churches. They can bring teachers in to help, but they're two different types of people in those cases.
Thank you, George Barna, Executive Director of American Culture and Faith Institute, for being with us today. Great, great information. I think you just made a point there real well. Teaching relates information, but preaching is an act of persuasion. We need preaching from the pulpit that moves people's heart to act in a certain way. That's how a culture is changed. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for being with us today. We encourage you to be with us tomorrow, 23 hours from now, on Staying in the Gap Today, as we pick up on these same types of very important topics.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to Stand in the Gap Today with Sam Rohr, Gary Dahl, and David Kistler. Brought to you by the American Pastors Network. Every day on this station, we address the most urgent issues undermining the culture from a biblical and constitutional perspective. APN takes seriously the command to be salt and light in this culture. Our mission is to declare truth into the public square, bringing a biblical worldview to the issues of the day. We seek to build a dynamic network of pastors across the nation who hold firmly to the authority of Scripture and boldly preach the whole counsel of God. This ministry is supported through the prayers and financial support of people like you, and we urge you to do all you can to help the American Pastors Network accomplish this mission. To learn more, visit www.AmericanPastorsNetwork.net and help us with your donation today. Find out how we're impacting the culture and how you can join in the mission. Join us again tomorrow for Stand in the Gap Today.
If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and heal their land. 2 Chronicles 7:14. WFYL reminds you to pray for America.
Broadcasting live from historic West Norriton Township, this is AM 1180.